most patients are overtly or potentially unstable.
Putting a non-invasive mask on that patient could be devastating.
The utilization of a pre-procedural checklist prevented what could have been some potential catastrophic airway issues over the years. Welcome, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. This is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. So happy and really overjoyed that you are joining us for yet another podcast here on CCPEM. Got a great discussion for you on a very common critically ill procedure that we do, I think, almost daily in the ED and ICU. But before getting to that, as we always do, let me bring in the amazing co-hosts here, Dr. Peter W. and Dr. John Greenwood. We will say that Dr. Rodriguez has been called to an urgent meeting at the time of our recording, so he is missing this recording, missing this month, but assuredly he will be back with us soon. So let me turn to Dr. W. How are things, Peter?
Things are great. It's not cool yet in South Louisiana. Still hot, still humid. So we're anxiously awaiting fall, even though it was supposed to be fall already. But things are good.
Well, no introduction when we do these podcasts would be complete without some festival going on in New Orleans. Anything down there at this point?
Still some small music festivals and blues festivals, not to the level of jazz festival, but great music festivals abound still.
Sounds great. Dr. Greenwood, how are things in Philadelphia?
Well, things are going great in Philly. We are less than a year out from the summer of 2026. And I know that sounds like a long time from now, but interesting enough, in Philly, it's going to be the 250th anniversary of America. And we have a ton of events coming to Philadelphia, including the World Cup, the MLB All-Star Game. There's going to be a national celebration in Philly. And I've had the chance to work with a few people at Penn who are developing the emergency action plan for how to handle any sort of major events. And that's been a lot of fun. It's been eye-opening. Logistically, sounds really challenging, but planning for things like sudden cardiac arrest within the city and a few other things. So it's been a lot of fun, and it's less than a year away. And so time flies. So we're looking forward to it, but in preparation for all the things to come next summer.
That sounds like a lot of fun and a lot of work, but necessary work.
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's pivot back now to some education. And as I led off a few minutes ago, a very common procedure that we do in critically ill patients, not only in the ED, but in the intensive care unit, and that is endotracheal intubation. And we're going to do a little something different than our normal podcast, where we take the latest hot off the press original article and go through that and what are the implications with respect to clinical care. We're going to cover a paper, but this is more of a clinical policy paper. Just got published in the Annals of Emergency Medicine, entitled Critical Issues in the Management of Adult Patients Requiring Endotracheal Intubation in the Emergency Department. Now, over the past many months, past few years, those of you that continue to listen here on CCPEM know that we've covered on various segments, articles, research studies that are leading into this overall clinical policy statement and recommendations from ASEP. But we've really not put it fully together as they do reviewing the evidence and ultimately making recommendations. And what can we take back to the bedside with us the next time we are performing endotracheal intubation? So with that, I'm turning things over to Dr. W. to give us the background of this clinical policy statement, and then we'll lead into two of the critical questions that they review.
Great. Thanks, Mike. And so we know that as emergency medicine practitioners that we often intubate our sickest patients. We don't get to play the anesthesia game and cancel cases. We don't get to keep our patients NPO. And we really don't have a full list of the medicines that the patients took before making their way to our doors. Though it's common, endotracheal intubation is a very high-risk procedure, with approximately 17% of emergency department intubations complicated by peri-intubation major adverse events. And those are listed as hypoxemia, hypotension, cardiovascular collapse, which we've spoken about here, and then, in fact, cardiac arrest. It's not to mention the more minor ones to include aspiration and then airway trauma. You know, unlike controlled anesthesia intubations in the OR, patients in the emergency department who require intubation have a wide variety of clinical conditions that must be considered. In essence, most patients are overtly or potentially unstable with limited reserves that place them at increased risk of side effects of induction, intubation, and then the initiation of positive pressure ventilation. Right? So there's a lot of unknowns that we have at the bedside that we need to be prepared for. Efforts to optimize the patient's physiology prior to intubation to avoid these side effects is really critical for us. We must understand who's going to benefit from the intubation, who may not benefit from the intubation, and how to best prepare for cardiovascular collapse.
Outstanding background, Peter. So, with that background, Peter, let me just hit the highlights of this clinical policy statement by ACEP. And importantly, they state that this policy seeks to address to minimize peri-intubation physiologic decompensation. Peter, you mentioned that these major adverse events of hypoxemia, hypotension may ultimately lead to cardiovascular collapse and cardiac arrest. And we're going to get to questions surrounding how to minimize hypoxemia and address or minimize hypotension in the peri-intubation period. Importantly, this policy statement, if you've read it and will read it, it's not intended to be a complete manual overall on the evaluation and management of patients, adult patients in our ED who need endotracheal intubation. Rather, it's going to focus specifically on the critical questions around peri-intubation hypoxemia, along with hypotension. The goal in developing this updated clinical policy statement is really to provide the latest evidence-based recommendations when the literature does have a signal that it would provide sufficient quality of information to make a recommendation on these questions. Importantly, and I think this is well stated in the policy, this is not intended to represent a legal standard of care for emergency physicians. And while they have the evidence and make recommendations, this is really at a high level with respect to the general population of patients we intubate in the ED. And importantly, it's not a one size fits all. They very much acknowledge that some patients may have specific anatomic, physiologic derangements that you will need to take into account and adjust for as you intubate them. Super quickly here, that class of evidence, you're very much used to this. Level A, these are accepted principles for patient care, reflecting a high degree of certainty within the literature. Level B, essentially recommendations for patient care that may identify a particular strategy or range of strategies that reflect moderate certainty. And then lastly, level C, recommendations for patient care that are based on evidence from overall lower quality studies, or if there's really no evidence to support it, expert consensus. So with that, Dr. Greenwood, I'm going to turn to you for this first critical question. And that question is for adults presenting to the ED who require endotracheal intubation, are there periprocedural interventions that can reduce the incidence of peri-intubation hypoxemia? Here, the committee found no or made no level A recommendations, but they do have a fairly significant level B recommendation that, when feasible, optimize pre-oxygenation using non-invasive ventilation over conventional O2 therapy. And a level C recommendation, well, when you don't have non-invasive ventilation, think about high flow nasal cannula for pre-oxygenation. Consider VL, not necessarily recommending, but consider VL in patients being intubated in the ED, and then consider using apneic oxygenation. So that was more of a consensus finding based upon expert opinion. So, John, what are your thoughts on their recommendations, and really, what do you do at the bedside?
So I think this is a great question, definitely a topic that we've covered here on CCPM with literature over the past 1 to 2 years that has taught us a little bit about how to reduce these hypoxemic episodes when we're pushing RSI meds and about to intubate either the patient with pneumonia or early ARDS, and we're concerned that there may be a high risk of desaturation during intubation. I think that the level evidence recommendation for non-invasive is pretty good or pretty accurate, I would say. I do try to use non-invasive when possible. And I think this comes down to how much time that you have ready to set up. Practically speaking, if you have a patient who comes in by EMS and they have a non-rebreather on and you make that decision in the moment that you need to intubate now, it's totally possible that you don't have time or respiratory therapy readily available that they might be able to come to the bedside and set the patient up on CPAP or non-invasive. And so, in that circumstance, I may decide, well, we need to act now. And I may choose, after pushing my paralytic and my sedative, to do something as simple as providing some simple bag valve mask ventilations. And that has been also shown to reduce the incidence of hypoxemia, and that's been shown in the literature. So I think that utilizing non-invasive or some degree of CPAP to try to recruit as much alveoli as possible prior to intubation is perfectly reasonable and something ideally I can do, but it might not always be possible. And in terms of the other level C recommendations, I can say that at University of Pennsylvania, we've largely moved to video laryngoscopy, and that's not necessarily the hyperangulated blade GlideScope laryngoscope geometry. It's just using video as a tool to facilitate intubation. We probably use that on 90% or more of our intubations in the emergency department and in the ICU. And that study came out probably within the past 2 years, where first pass success rates leaned towards significant in the video laryngoscopy groups. Although there's some degree of expertise that comes into play. So if I was doing it by myself, not with a resident or a trainee, I may choose to use direct laryngoscopy if video is not readily available, but certainly VL has taken over at our place. And then lastly, the discussion of level C recommendations for apneic oxygenation, I can honestly say we don't routinely do this at University of Pennsylvania. If the patient has CPAP already in place or non-invasive mask in place, I don't replace it with a nasal cannula. I just proceed down the RSI pathway. So I think that using those three key interventions, or two interventions at least, of non-invasive when possible and utilization of video laryngoscopy has definitely reduced the incidence of hypoxemia that I've experienced in my emergency department. Looking through kind of the remainder of the policy statement, they do talk about a few other things, specifically pre-procedural checklists, patient positioning, utilization of a bougie, even as a primary for intubation, and then medication choice. I can say of those, probably the most helpful, in my opinion, based on the literature and experience, is patient positioning. So I routinely will place patients in a ramped position of about 25 degrees and trying to achieve that ear to sternal notch or a pharyngeal alignment definitely helps me visualize the cords better and reduce the amount of intra-abdominal pressure that caused some de-recruitment. So while the level of evidence recommendation wasn't as high for patient positioning, that is certainly something that I have incorporated into my practice on a day-to-day basis.
Really, really outstanding comments there, John. I want to bring Peter in. What's your thoughts, reflections on this? Similar to John, what do you do at the bedside?
So there's two things different from what John said. And so we're using VL, we use pre-oxygenation. We do oxygenation maybe 50% of the time, particularly those who are difficult to oxygenate. For non-invasive mechanical ventilation, I just really want to bring up a point that the humidified high-flow nasal cannula is not for our hypercapnic patients, right? It's for our hypoxic patients, but if you have CO2 retention, you should be using BiPAP to help facilitate removal of that CO2. You won't get that with humidified high-flow nasal cannula. The other thing that I tend to do is if I have a woefully unstable patient, or if I have profound challenges with physiology or dynamic anatomy, right? So an expanding hematoma, a bloody airway, I really do coach the utilization of bougie because you may not get a second chance, right? And so you get a glimpse of cord, get the bougie in, and then you can muck around and say, was it the right size tube or not the right size tube? Do I need a smaller tube? And so for those dynamic airways associated with unstable physiology, and particularly with dynamic anatomy, I'm promote bougie.
Outstanding, Peter. And I think it's worth stating that early in this clinical policy, the authors do address here, they're looking at interventions that reduce hypoxemia. They didn't bring in first pass success, which, Peter, I think you may be referencing with respect to that potential airway, the trauma, the bleeding, the expanding hematoma. While they found less evidence on bougie stylet with hypoxemia, didn't really bring in that whole first pass success component and successfully getting the tube. Now, I'm going to correct myself already because I stated at the beginning that Dr. Rodriguez had an urgent meeting he was called to. And as our surprise, he walked in that meeting, made his comments, dropped the mic, left, and has joined us here on the podcast. And so, Rob, can't wait to hear your thoughts. We didn't get you on the intro, but thoughts as we're evolving this conversation here on peri-intubation hypoxemia.
Yeah, thanks for that reintroduction. I was actually testifying on behalf of Jimmy Kimmel, by the way. So yeah, I like these recommendations. I echo everything that John and Peter said. I don't really have too much to add other than I do pay a lot of attention to not only positioning in terms of getting the alignment of the airway, but also gravitational effects on the diaphragm and on secondary ventilation. I almost always use a ramp at least 30 degrees, up to 45 degrees ramp when I'm intubating obese patients. And so I'm in complete agreement with their guideline recommendations. And yeah, I think there's sort of no downside recommendations. In other words, it may seem like you're overdoing it when you do these pre-intubation procedures, but never know when until you're in there how difficult an airway is going to be and how rapidly somebody might deoxygenate. So I think it's pretty much a checklist type thing for me.
Yeah, I think what Rob and Peter is saying is 100% true, that it's almost like an ounce of prevention, right, is worth a pound of cure. So taking your time is really important here. But I think based off of what I've read, would you guys agree that it doesn't seem like these policy statements have really considered a couple of really important subpopulations, if you will? I think this is probably more for the general hypoxemic patient. And I think it's important, particularly in the head trauma, right? Putting a non-invasive mask on that patient could be devastating, right? Or high flow nasal cannula, cause pneumocephalus, whatever. So certainly as you're reading through these policy statements, I think clearly identifying that this is for the general patient is super important.
Well said, gentlemen. I'll add just one other thing to this, and focusing on whether it prevents peri-intubation hypoxemia, they did essentially say the use of pre-procedural checklists didn't alter that. And I'll be honest, we have implemented an RSI checklist at Maryland, and we have certainly found that the utilization of a pre-procedural checklist or an RSI checklist, as we term it, has really prevented what could have been some potential catastrophic airway and intubation issues over the years. In the sometimes frenetic nature of getting ready to intubate someone outside of the OR and in our setting, it's really helped us in ensuring that should we need to perform BVM, oh yes, it's actually connected to O2 and suction, and the bougie is present. So we have found value overall in just in doing that checklist. It may not, once again, as the policy states, they didn't find evidence that it prevented hypoxemia, but we have found value in that.
So I would echo that. When you look at these recommendations and the level of evidence, they're really only looking at like very hard outcomes, like the incidence of hypoxemia and the even harder outcome of full-on decompensation secondary to respiratory arrest. Those are very, very hard outcomes. What they're not looking at are provider outcomes, like the stress induced by not being prepared or not having pre-oxygenated a patient and not doing these measures. I bet if they did a study looking at the level of stress and other types of outcomes on providers doing the intubations, that they would find that these checklists and these series of pre-intubation measures reduce intubator anxiety and distress.
I like that, Rob. Well, Rob, don't go too far because now we're going to transition to the second question. I'm going to start with you. That second question in this clinical policy for adults presenting to the ED requiring intubation, are there periprocedural interventions that can reduce the incidence of peri-intubation hypotension? So now switching from hypoxemia to hypotension, no level A recommendation, but level B recommendation is to use ketamine or etomidate as your induction agent to reduce the risk of peri-intubation hypotension. Level C recommendations, avoid fentanyl, avoid midazolam, avoid propofol as an induction or a co-induction agent for patients requiring intubation in the ED overall to reduce the risk of peri-intubation hypotension. So, Rob, I'm going to now start off with you. Reflections, thoughts on these recommendations, this clinical question.
Yeah, so the potential benefit of implementing these recommendations are fewer episodes of hypotension, but I believe there have been some studies that show an actual reduction in mortality and light level of evidence for that. You have to consider the potential harm in implementing those recommendations, which would be adverse events associated with use of, let's say, ketamine as an induction agent. You might, in some cases, get vomiting. You might get tachycardia. You might get some other adverse events. And so their brief summary was to consider the choice of induction agents and the dosing of those induction agents, avoid co-induction agents of propofol and midazolam and fentanyl. Consider fluid bolus administration prior to or during intubation. That is something that I routinely consider. And their brief summary was that you should consider methods to optimize the patient's physiology to reduce the incidence of hypotension, including fluid bolus administration, choice of those agents, etomidate and ketamine, dose adjustments for patients who might be already hypotensive or already have altered level of consciousness. In other words, in a patient who's comatose already before your induction agent, you might not need a full dose of etomidate or ketamine, and then consideration of the use of vasopressors. And so what do I do? I've never really used fentanyl, propofol, or midazolam for intubation. I don't really see their utility in that regard. I think that etomidate and ketamine are near perfect agents for induction. I do commonly use fentanyl after intubation. That's sort of a different topic. But in terms of my choice of induction agents, I already use ketamine and etomidate. I do reduce the dose in patients who are hypotensive and already comatose. I do commonly give a fluid bolus prior to intubation and after intubation. I commonly will have a stick of phenylephrine in my hand to deliver right during intubation or right after intubation. So I'm a fan of all those measures. I think that there's really very little downside to all of those interventions I just discussed.
Thanks, Rob. Really outstanding comments. But I'm going to turn things to Peter now for reflections and things that you do at the bedside with respect to reducing peri-intubation hypotension.
So thanks, Mike. And I agree with the measures that Rob takes. A couple of things that I'm concerned about by this recommendation is if rocuronium was used as a paralytic agent, and this is recommending not to use any other agents other than etomidate or ketamine, there's a strong likelihood that you're going to have someone awake and paralyzed. And we've reviewed that here before, and that's something that we should avoid, and that emergency medicine physicians do it about 10 times more than anesthesia and folks in the OR. The other thing that I would mention is Rob likes phenylephrine, and I like that. I'm not a hater for that. I'm a hater for the second pen of phenylephrine. So if you use phenylephrine one time, that's your call. And I would say if I had lousy physiology to start, I would do ultrasound and I would assess the tank and also assess the pump and look to see what the LV function was like to make a determination that do I need just levofed at the bedside or do I need levofed and dobutamine at the bedside, depending on the LV level of dysfunction. And if there's woeful hypokinesis with the LV, then I'm going to have dobutamine at the bedside in addition to levofed.
Yeah, really like that those comments, Peter. I want to turn to John now. Bring us home on this question as we drive towards the end of this. I feel it's been an amazing discussion on this policy statement.
Yeah, just a couple of points. I think we've, as a specialty, moved into using a lot more ketamine over the past 10 years. But with that, we've also learned a lot about ketamine as an induction drug. The EVK trial, I believe it was, up to a third of those patients developed hypotension when compared to the etomidate group. So it's not a drug that just increases your cardiac output and reduces the incidence of hypotension. You have to be prepared for the patient to drop their blood pressure. And I do the same thing as Rob, as having a stick of phenylephrine at the bedside, just to add some detail about how I use it. So we set our blood pressure cuff, if they don't have an A-line, to cycle every minute. And I hand it to my nurse and I ask them if I'm at the head of the bed with the resident or whoever, if that mean arterial pressure gets to 60, I want you to push 100 of mics of phenylephrine and then let me know what the response is. And having that awareness for my second set of eyes at the foot of the bed allows me to have that mental clarity of not having to worry about the blood pressure per se, because I have someone who's watching that on a frequent basis. I think that's really helpful. I do use a lot of ultrasound as well. I don't routinely give a fluid bolus prior to intubation. We reviewed a trial that showed, I believe, that there was no difference in hypotension. And that's only because you have to know the patient's physiology to understand if that's actually going to provide any benefit. So it's not a routine thing, but if my ultrasound shows that I'm hypovolemic and if I add positive pressure, I'm going to drop my preload, absolutely. Fluid bolus all the way. And lastly, this is something, and I don't know, maybe I'm just paranoid, but I still, even if the patient appears to be unconscious, I will still administer some amount of Etomidate if it's like half dose Etomidate or whatever. I think the study that we reviewed, I'm totally blanking on the lead author who looked at awareness after paralytic for intubation and how frequent it was, somewhere around like 6% of ED intubations. I'm super paranoid that I'm going to mistake comatose with a patient who's aware and I can't recognize that. So I will give at least half dose Etomidate to those patients prior to RSI. So it may be overkill, but maybe just a personal paranoia of mine.
Yeah, I think those are really, really good points. To clarify, I don't give everybody a bolus. I give the people that are marginal and that I kind of have an idea that they may drop their pressure. I think there's a lot of built-in intuition. The other measure that I failed to discuss is at right after intubation, I avoid that vigorous hyperventilation that occurs. I tell my RTs to just give them small ventilations. You don't need to overbag them and reduce their preload in that capacity.
Yeah, Rob, thanks for reminding me. Brian Driver, CHEST 2023, the recall study. That was it. Thanks for the reminder. Shout out to Brian.
He's done an amazing amount of research into this topic. And I would guess that half the articles that are cited are by one of his teams. Peter?
Yes. Well, one of the things that I wanted to bring up, and we probably should have led with this, is that as emergency medicine physicians, if we have a horrific sepsis case that dies, that's not unexpected. If we have a horrific trauma case that dies, that's not unexpected. If we have a horrific neuro critical care patient that dies, that's not unexpected. However, we hold ourselves to a separate standard for airway. So if we're managing an airway and because of our choices, that patient succumbs or that patient dies, that's unexpected. And we hold ourselves to a different standard in that expectation. Whether we fail to get the airway or in getting the airway, we tip the patient and the patient succumbed and died. That's something that's not expected. And so we need to pay attention to our literature. We need to be cautious with how we approach the airway because we are the emergency airway experts. Anesthesia is not, right? They don't see this. They're in a different world. Are they airway experts in their environment? Yes. You take them out of the OR and you place them in another environment and they're very uncomfortable. It doesn't mean that our intensivist colleagues aren't experts as well in the ICU. In their environment, they are. And this kind of plays out these precautions or this attention to both physiologic and anatomic abnormalities is critical for us to review.
I don't think there's a better way to wrap up this discussion than those comments, Peter. So much appreciated. I feel that this has been an incredibly beneficial discussion. I want to thank my three co-stars here on CCPEM for comments on an important paper. I think it provides a good summary of the evidence as it pertains to hypoxemia and hypotension. So certainly want to congratulate all the members of the clinical policy committee who drafted this, took the time to review it, and then to the three of you for this really, really robust discussion. If you have any questions, please shoot us a note through the website. Happy to continue the conversation as many of you do following each and every one of our episodes. We'll go ahead and close this podcast down, and we very much look forward to talking with you on our next podcast. Bye for now.